capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. In the midst of many bold statements about fake news, Donald Trump has threatened to shut down NBC and some other American networks. Now, how seriously should we take Trump's statements, and what does all this mean for press freedom in the United States? To discuss this, I welcome to the programme Rob Torp, a TV commentator, best-selling author and writer for Huffington Post, and also Professor Daniel Kovelik, lecturer of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome both of you gentlemen to the programme.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the latest attack on privately run U.S. networks comes after NBC reported Mr. Trump had sought to increase America's nuclear arsenal tenfold. And the story cited three officials who were reportedly in the room when Mr. Trump made the comments. And then the president of America tweeted, "Fake NBC News made up a story that I wanted a tenfold increase in our U.S. nuclear arsenal." Now, some of us, I guess, observing this from a distance, this all seems rather bizarre. I guess for some of you too, it must seem rather bizarre. But I do have a question. While we're perhaps thinking that we can take Donald Trump's threats to close down NBC in particular with a pinch of salt, but could this actually happen? I mean, could NBC's license and other networks be revoked?
I mean, theoretically, any network could lose their license. That would be an act of the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission. But that would be an extreme move. It is incomprehensible to me inconceivable that it would ever happen. We have very strong First Amendment free speech protections in the United States. I just don't think that would happen. And truthfully, Trump, he lives and dies by the media. And in fact, he kind of riffs off the media. That's how he got elected. So I don't take it seriously.
Yeah. Rob, I take it you kind of follow that line as well?
I don't take it seriously that he can do anything like have a license revoked, but I think Trump's level of mad genius is he knows how to undermine an entire industry, as he's proven with the NFL, which owns a day of the week in this country. Mm. And he's disrupted that. And his intention is not to actually do anything himself to the media, but to galvanize his base, which is a still, unfortunately, a large part of our country. And they hate what they see as the mainstream media. And that can be damaging because the president wields power. He divides and polarizes our country. And as a journalist, it's disturbing to me because occasionally you'll hear a story where somebody who worked for the New York Times or anywhere who've been found out that they've created a fake story or fake stories. But the fact of the matter is, I've always been held to real journalistic ethics when I've worked for Time Incorporated. We had editors and fact checkers, and my notes were always requested when I wrote the simplest thing. I once wrote a piece about Dean Koontz, who's an author, and said that he writes about sociopaths, and I needed to back that up with data, or they weren't going to run the story, and that was in People magazine. So yeah. I've always been held to standards, and that's what journalism is about, and that's what disturbs Trump, is that we have a set of ethics and standards, and he has none.
Yeah, you've brought up a lot of very interesting points there. Thank you. And I think the first thing I'd like to perhaps probe into a little more depth would be, you quite rightly pointed out that Trump sort of feeds off the media. He's like sort of some media junkies, or maybe media vulture. I'm not sure what the right description is. But nevertheless, I'm just thinking about this idea that Trump's using the idea of real people, and the real people are the kind of mythological, poor, neglected, humble, sincere Americans who live somewhere out of the way, who are working very hard every day of their life, and their voice has not been heard, and he's representing them. And therefore, anybody who's criticizing him is criticizing these, quote, real Americans. Is that how it's working or not?
He calls them the forgotten Americans.
The forgotten Americans. That's even more romantic, isn't it? That really fits in with the mythology. But that's very powerful, isn't it? I mean, that's a really powerful way of leveraging and negotiating your power base.
Yes, I mean, it's very clever. I mean, that's what demagogues do.
Yeah.
You know, he is a demagogue.
Yeah.
And he is an effective one and should not be underestimated in terms of his effectiveness. Although, what I do want to point out, I mean, I agree that, you know, Trump is unhinged, unethical, but I actually do think there is truth to the fact that the mainstream media is, I think, has abdicated its role as the watchman of the government. I think, especially when it comes to foreign policy, the media does usually promote the State Department line on things, I think is not good, is not doing what they should be doing, and is undermining democratic values in this country. I mean, the truth is there is a deficit, I think, of truth in the mainstream press, again, especially when it comes to foreign policy.
Yeah, I guess, Rob, I mean, perhaps a veiled attack on you now as a journalist, and actually on me also as a journalist. You mentioned that the old school journalists, you know, facts were checked, and God help you if you've got them wrong. You know, you'd never get that promotion. But are they fact checked now? I mean, are the New York Times and Washington Post headlines?
You both brought up good points.
Checked, but, you know, during the election campaign, some of those attacks actually on Trump, did they not? Perhaps at that time, the sort of devaluation, the unlinking of the press with credibility, had begun before Trump was actually elected.
The media is evolving and changing, unfortunately, because of the internet, because now it's nearly impossible to make a living as a journalist. So, and every day there's some new site that you can find on the internet or pops up on Twitter that's reporting, and there is no way to test the validity of a lot of these, I don't even know what to call them, media entities. Mm. So that is a problem. The other thing is, and it comes, this is something Rupert Murdoch addressed over 10 years ago, is he asked, where are we going to go when media doesn't have the money anymore to have foreign news bureaus and to really pay the reporters well, because you can't pay for a level of investigative journalism where somebody works on a story for 6 or 9 months and probes and investigates. There's no budget for it. Somebody, they won't be able, forget about being able to fly somewhere. They're not even going to be able to be paid for it. So there's some stories I'd like to cover now, but there's no financial wherewithal to support me in doing so.
Yeah, and if the press goes down the tube, then as the press plays such a hugely important part in democracy, and American democracy is no exception, then my question would be, do we have democracy still? Is that concept also old-fashioned?
I don't think it's old-fashioned, but I think there are a lot of warning signs that are, well, I mean, Jimmy Carter himself said a couple years ago that we do not have a functioning democracy. We have more of an oligarchy. It is so infected with the power of money, especially after the Supreme Court decided the case of Citizens United, which freed up limits on campaign financing. I think we have a real problem. You have this problem that Greg Palast has noted with this cross-check system, which has knocked tens of thousands of people off the voter rolls who should be on the rolls.
Yeah.
Largely the Republicans are behind that. They're behind also racist gerrymandering in the United States. I think about how democratic our country is, and I think the problem is getting worse.
Yeah, we're talking about some very serious issues here. We started off with talking about the possibility that Trump could actually do away with some, close down some of these channels, and we decided that's probably not very likely. Now we're talking about the existence of democracy in general, you know, if that is sustainable. But, I mean, in your opinion, what's going to happen? I mean, NBC is going to carry on, so is CNN, and so is CBS and Fox News and everybody else. But are we going to see perhaps a polarization of audiences, even more than we have now? A polarization perhaps along demographic patterns, where you have sort of the democratic people living in one part of a state or a country and the more democratic people living in the other part. Are we going to see a real polarization of audiences?
Audiences are really polarized right now.
They're already polarized. Yeah, okay. But they're going to be more polarized.
You know, people tend to forget, I mean, what I think it was a Time magazine cover story that talked about at one point Bernie Sanders was the most popular Democratic candidate in the country in terms of with voters. I mean, when you're talking about financial power and wherewithal, Hillary did have have the big money behind her, and that was a factor. But to me, it's very frightening that somebody like that, given his age and his politics and being an extreme ideologue, could have been a viable presidential candidate this day and age. And I'm a Democrat, and it really scared me, because they think there were just naive ideologues and millennials behind him who are young and highly opinionated with no knowledge base. And they had an avowed socialist there who wants to give as everything he calls is free, but of course somebody's paying for it, and it's untenable. And then you have somebody on the other end of the spectrum being Trump, who is selling all sizzle and no steak. And, you know, again, there's no there, as Gertrude Stein once said, with either candidate. So you have two extremes that are really not viable. And that, to me, is a highly polarized country, which is not what this is. Our Constitution is based on. We have checks and balances, and bipartisanship is what makes us an effective country.
I have to say on that point, I would have to disagree. I think Bernie Sanders, first of all, is still, latest polls show him to be the most popular politician. And I will just say that his rise, I think, gives me some hope that there can actually be some chance of democracy and change in this country, as opposed to two-party state, where the two parties, frankly, aren't that much different from each other.
Let's take a short break here.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Program. Today we're discussing freedom of press in the United States of America. I'm talking to Rob Torp, TV commentator, best-selling author and writer of Huffington Post, and Professor Daniel Kovalik, lecturer of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome back, everybody. Now, we've had a very interesting conversation so far about the whole nature of the press in the States. But what worries me is that the further we travel down this road of journalists, because of the market, because of the appearance of internet, because it's no longer considered to be a safe and stable career, standards are slipping. And we are all, us journalists, at the mercy, really, of forces that perhaps we could previously fender off, we could avoid. I'm talking about political pressure and, of course, commercial pressure. And I'm sure in America you have both. And they're both very powerful. So magazines, newspapers, radio stations, television outlets are all owned by one or two or three of these parties. And my question would be to you, how long can the remaining credibility of these news outlets in the States remain at a level high enough where people will still go to you to listen to your news, Rob, and not to one of these fly-by-night, you know, man is dog internet newspapers that you were talking about before?
It's an interesting scenario, because my father was a member of the press. This is like in the 60s and the 50s. He always used to tell the story of Clifton Daniel, who was a famous New York Times reporter and went on to be managing editor, and he was a Southern gentleman. And I think it was somebody said to Harry Truman, "Who's here?" And he said, "A bunch of reporters and a gentleman of the press," referring to Daniel.
Right.
So they were never always popular, but nonetheless, and also my father used to tell stories of being at the Carlisle Hotel with President Kennedy when he was there seeing for various dangerous liaisons, and it was just not reported. But since we've gone to a 24-hour news cycle, we're not just giving the news, we're really more foisting opinions on people. That's pretty much what it is. If you went back to pre-24-hour news cycles, you had, well, I love what the Brits call it, because this is really more what they are, news readers, somebody who sits at a desk and reads from a prompter, gives you the news, and reports the facts of the day, and you had to tune into a specific time. Now we have handheld devices, we have a 24-hour news cycle, and so you turn on your television at any time of the day to hear somebody on a number of different channels spouting their opinion. As my grandmother, who English was her third language, if she was alive today and saw this, she would say, yatata, 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 nonstop talking.
Yeah, but that means that standards are dropping on consumers as well, that we, as consumers, consumers, you know, are also not really, you know, critically appraising what we're reading and hearing. And I guess this has been going on over the last couple of decades, and we've got used to this, to standards dropping. And it's no longer unusual that we have a newspaper headline shouting loudly, you know, like, kill this wherever they are, you know, without justifying why or whoever, you know. It's normal. And this is disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. But again, I see the bigger problem, the existing problem we have, is with the established press, which honestly has lied us into every war we've had since World War II. And, you know, the idea that you know, it's a shame that people won't be reading the New York Times anymore, I don't think it's a shame.
Okay.
They pushed the weapons of mass destruction lie harder than anyone, you know, which, you know, 1 million dead Iraqis later was a disaster. And you can go on and on with that. The lies that led us to the war in Libya. Look at Libya now. There's slaves being sold on open markets there after that invasion. That was based on lies. I mean, look, I agree that there's a problem with people not knowing where to go to find facts and find the truth. But I don't think the established press is the place to go.
Right.
Especially, again, for foreign policy.
I wanted to ask Dan a question.
Yeah.
As you're a law professor. I'm assuming you're a lawyer as well?
I'm a lawyer, yes. Yes.
Yeah, so lawyers do their due diligence and research, and I see now, today, we have, as the public, more information on our fingertips than ever before. People seem, I don't even want to say misinformed, it's almost uninformed. I'd love to go to the Inspector General reports, which you could just Google Inspector General and read about anything you want. You could Google Inspector General wall, and it will come up all the reports written about how much money we've wasted trying to build border walls in this country. So there's also a surprising amount of information available that nobody, including journalists, seems to take advantage of. I guess I'm just throwing this out there. I don't know what the solution is, but there is more information there than people realize.
Well, and I agree with that, and that is a good thing. I mean, look, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing, because there's a lot of good information out there that is at your fingertips, as you say, but then there's a lot of junk out there, too, and how do people sort through that? And that is a difficult thing, and I don't know what the answer is to that. People have to, in many ways, discover that for themselves. You know, obviously we need a better education system which at least gives some folks a certain compass about where to do that. You know, I mean, I'll just give you an example. I mean, I teach a law school class, and I had a section on the Vietnam War. You know, these are 20-something-year-old students, not a thing about that war. You know, and again, there's just deep problems in this country in terms of educating people.
May I say, Dan, I don't think it's just your country. I think it's a global thing. It's something to do with the internet. I mean, I've said a little bit about this thing called the echo chamber theory, where we, although there is a universe of information literally at our fingertips, we tend to go to those sites, those sources of information, which sort of don't confront us too much, you know, don't tell us anything really uncomfortable that we don't want to hear, or we fit in with those people or that mindset, you know. And this happens all the time. I think we do it on a subconscious level. And so just because the information is there doesn't mean to say that people are going to use it. But a major question I think that listeners would like to know the answer to is that how long can America really say that its press is reflecting different sides, different versions of the truth, when we have a media in the United States of America that seems to be really only serving as a mouthpiece for one or the other? And that's at the most, you know, two at the most, and in many cases, just one version of the truth. This is a serious thing, and it's going to affect the rest of the world, because if your press goes down, it goes down everywhere, as far as I can work out.
Well, I think, again, I mean, I think we also have to look beyond what is considered the mainstream press. I mean, there is some very vibrant...
Yeah, okay, sure.
You know, journalism being done out there, and I think, you know, Sputnik and RTE have some very good things to contribute, and those are the ones that are, by the way, that the government has its sights on. Those are the ones that are going to be...
Yes,
that are being
we've heard about that.
We've
heard about that.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Google also has changed some algorithms to move people away from more alternative, you know, left-wing publications like Counterpunch, The Nation, that sort of thing. And those are, you know, there's some valuable stuff being written in those items. So, you know, again, the question is how do people find those alternative press? And again, I think it's the alternative press that I'm more concerned about about than I am the established press at this point.
You mean you're more concerned about the survival of the alternative press?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Okay, right.
Yes,
you're not
I
concerned
am.
Too much about the content, although because you already think that the content of the alternative press is richer than that of the mainstream press. Is that what you're saying?
I think in some of it. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's some junk in some, you know, so-called alternative press, but there's some very good stuff being done. And again, when it comes to foreign policy, I think that's where, you know, you can get some facts that you're not going to hear ever in the mainstream press.
Yeah. Rob, I mean, I believe you work in the mainstream press. I'm actually not quite sure, but
yes.
What's your feeling? I mean, do you think the mainstream press will be able to adapt, is adapting, or really doesn't give a bloop, you know?
I talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's evolving, and I really wonder where it's going to be in 20 years.
It's evolving, okay.
And Dan's, yeah. I think so much of it is financial, because you could have a young upstart alternative news organization, and it's like, if they're not well-funded, how are they going to go on? Somebody I used to work with who was a producer at Fox News, and everybody thinks everybody who worked
well,
at Fox...
Well, just a minute, Rob. May I just challenge you that on Matt's point? I mean, I've just started off a very small website here in Moscow, and I'm earning about a tenth of, or maybe a 20th or even a 50th of the income that used to come into the more mainstream outlet that I was working for before. But I don't have any outgoings, you know. I mean, it's, I can survive on that. I can survive producing a view of the world that is different from some of the other people doing the same thing here, because I don't need so much money coming in. I mean, this is the whole, it's the paradigm has changed. The whole way of producing news and broadcasting and distributing is changing. That's what you're facing.
Yes. Also, conversely, I mean, there are people, I'll use Bill Simmons, who's more of a sports guy, as an example. He started as a blogger, an unknown person in Boston, writing about the Red Sox and the Celtics, and he's become a media, almost a titan right now in our country.
Right.
Again, sports-related, but he had his own show on HBO. He was being paid $5 or $6 million a year when he left ESPN. And so it does offer some fascinating alternatives, and, you know, again, I don't want to make any predictions about where it's going to go, because, I mean, if I did, I'd be the burning bush. It's, you know, it's changing and evolving, and hopefully for the better. But, I mean, I could harken back to, I think, 35 years ago, Edward J. Epstein wrote a book called News from Nowhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, predicting the demise of the press pretty quickly, and it hasn't happened yet. And ultimately, I have faith in our country and in our people, and, you know, we're at a bump in the road right now. It doesn't mean that the car's going to crash.
Wow. I admire your spirit. I admire your optimistic view on everything. I'm just thinking that now more and more of it depends on the algorithms. It depends on the formulas. It depends on who's controlling, you know, that those flow of protons and electrons or however it works that come across the airways, that come into our computers and make the internet happen. I mean, even the mainstream press, I'm outside of America, and probably for many people in America, I rely on the internet. And if the internet's sort of controlled or semi-controlled, then God help us, surely.
I mean, we could also use somebody leading our country in the White House that brings people together and galvanizes us as a nation instead of dividing
yeah.
us, but we don't have
yeah.
that.
Yeah, but even if we have somebody in the White House who can do that, we have the same danger, don't we? I mean, whoever's in control, there's a danger that he, she, the administration, the elite, the establishment will try to control dissemination of information because it's in the interest of whoever is in power, you know, be it socialist, be it communist, be it Labour, be it, you know, right-wing conservatives, whatever, you know, they will try to control dissemination of information. And now we're no longer putting ink to paper. It all goes through screens and stuff. Isn't this situation much more dangerous than it was before?
Oh, I think so. I mean, and again, I keep going back to the U.S.'s foreign policy. I mean,
yeah.
and some of it is, you know, we don't even know where, you know, our troops are. We, you know, we have them in so many countries, and we're fighting wars that, you know, very few people know about. I mean, it's a very profound problem that we have in terms of accessing that information. I think people are already, frankly, hoodwinked when it comes to the issues of war and peace. And there's no debate, none, between the two parties on that issue. And I don't care who's in power. Obama was no saint when it came to foreign policy. He was terrible, in fact, and no one cared. He deported 2.5 million people, you know, and no one protested. I mean, there's a lot of things happening where there's just no debate at all anywhere.
Rob, you want to say something?
Trump is brilliant at diversionary tactics, too. I mean, right now there are millions of people dying in Yemen, and we're arguing about a bunch of multimillionaires and whether or not they should kneel at a football game.
Yeah.
There are many more important topics and subjects for us to tackle right now in the country and in the world, as America was once the free world colossus, and now we've become like a bunch of petty high school kids, except we have money and bombs.
Yeah, we're worried about whether Archie and Sputnik is undermining our democracy. Let me just read you a quote from 1984. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Final question. How far are we from that state of affairs?
We're there. We are there.
We are there.
We are in an Orwellian world.
We are in an Orwellian world. Rob?
I'm going to disagree. I think that just like everything else in life, we have our ups and downs, and what's going to test us is not how we do when things are going great, but when we face a real trial and tough set of circumstances. And we're in one right now in America, and we're going to have to test the resilience of our democracy and our people and our politicians. And maybe this will be a learning experience for us that will catapult us to better places. I hope so, because I have children aged 29 and 27, and I want to see them have a good, happy future and not one in chains and slavery. Or with President Donald Trump in his 16th term.
Fantastic. I really appreciate both of you coming on the program today. Rob Torp, TV commentator, best-selling author and a writer for Huffington Post, as well as Professor Daniel Kovalik, lecturer of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Your comments are very interesting, highly valid, and I wish we could continue this conversation, but I'm afraid we can't because we run out of time.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, listeners, for being with us. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.